This is the audio lecture file for section 4. The second of two sections looking at the changing landscape of spirituality. Now what we do here is we pick up and advance from that very, very significant table 2 at the end of section 3. And you'll see that I've even added a click access, ready access to that table if you need to go back to it again, because this is where we pick up, follow through and expand on some of these things a little more. Section 1 is like an introduction to this, or part 1 of this section 4 is like an introduction to this section, as well as a condensed summary reflection on where we've gone so far, where we have looked at the differences between the spiritual and the religious, between spirituality and a religious spirituality, basic human spirituality and religious spirituality. And we've commented on the role of the church school in trying to resource and enhance the basic human spirituality of students, while at the same time giving them comprehensive access to the cultural meanings of their religious tradition. So if you read through part 1 of this section, that will be the introduction and the summary. And I think you'll see that we are making use of this idea of a basic human spirituality with a cultural religious overlay that informs it, that energizes it, that motivates it, turns the basic human spirituality into a religious spirituality. So just how much people are going to draw on religious elements in the culture will vary from individual to individual. One of the roles of religious education is to make sure that young people have access to those cultural meanings. Now, the next major thing that we're going to do is to highlight and summarise some of the really significant things that have come through in the previous section. And what you would need to do here is to download a PowerPoint which tries to summarise diagrammatically the really fundamental, significant core changes in the way spirituality operated in a traditional Christian culture to the situation today where it is relatively secular, relatively materialistic and so on, where there's much more individuality and freedom. The animated part of the diagram, which you need to look at, click, I think it'll go through automatically. You look at the first few slides in the PowerPoint, and then when you click onto the diagram, it just runs through the diagram automatically with a commentary that I want you to listen to as it explains how the animated diagram works. And then when the animated diagram's over, you click one or two more slides to finish. This can be quite a shock for people, but what I've tried to do in the diagram is to summarise some of the really core differences between the two that we need to understand. And it is a bit of a shock. I'll leave that up to you to see. You need to know that any diagram is going to be an oversimplification. There's just no space in the diagram for recording the influence of family. It talks more about the way in which the dominant or prominent meanings in the culture can have a shaping influence on people's beliefs, values, religious and spiritual practices and so on. But I'd like you to take your time and go through the PowerPoint and the animated diagrams and see for yourself whether this makes sense of the changes for you. You may or may not agree, but I hope it will make some sense to you in a very stark and big picture way, to see the differences between the two spiritualities. And the other thing that I'd like to point out is that you might look at both of them and say, well, look, I don't like either of them. There are natural problems with any particular style of spirituality, as well as real possibilities and values. And that's the evaluative approach that we want to take when we're looking at a traditional, you know, medieval Christian spirituality, and we're looking at how things operate in the relatively secular contemporary sphere, where most of our young people are situated. So you'll need to pause the audio here and go through that animated PowerPoint that has to be downloaded first. And I'd like you to reflect on that and see what you think are the really important things that crop up in your mind as a result of looking at it. In section 3 and section 4 of the text, I've actually just written a summary of a further development of what was said in that explanation of the diagrams. So what I thought I would do is, I won't comment any further on that, but after you having looked at the animated diagram and thought about it, you can skim through what's written here under section 3 and under section 4 and see whether there are some summary points or whether there are some additional points that have been made that make sense of it. Well, I hope that you found the going through that material interesting, and I hope that you'll be able to articulate some of your responses in the question for it. The next bit of this section, number 5, looks briefly at, given these incredible changes, how has people's understanding or their image of God changed? And I've got here part of the research work done by one of our students here, Michael Moroney, some years back, was a student when I was at ACU, and he got one of his own students to draw the cartoons, and together they made up cartoon version of different images of God, and they gave them to Year 12 students, and they had discussions on what they thought of them and how they felt about them. And I'd like you can pause the audio here, have a download and have a look at his PowerPoint, and then you can also download or look at the summary that he had of the way the young people in his research study thought about God. Also, in part 5 of this section, there's an optional extra reading that you can have a look at if you wish, even if it's just something to skim over. It's interesting in that this was written back in 1978 about the beliefs of young people then, and you can see there may be some hints, even at that stage, that there was a secularisation occurring. So you might like to look at that and see how that compares and contrasts with the other material we've looked at on spirituality here, to see what did it look like, you know, some 40 years back, at least one person's view. Now, the final part of section 4 is like a general spiritual profile of today's young people. And again, this is a generalization that you can look at to help you try to understand the sort of thinking that's and feelings and attitudes of mind that are there for many young people. It doesn't fit every one, it doesn't fit all of them, but I think you'd see that it highlights some of the differences that reflect the cultural differences from the past to the present, and how young people today have an extraordinarily difficult road to hoe. I look at some of my grandnieces and grandnephews, and I worry, boy, they've got a much, much tougher culture and situation to make sense of and live in than I had as a, you know, a young boy in a little country town in Queensland in the mid-50s. So different from what things are like today. So again, I won't say anything about that in the lecture, but you can pause the audio and have a look through these 9 prominent elements that are, you know, common in the spirituality of contemporary young people. Just one or two comments. These are written by a colleague I've worked with for many years, Mrs. Marisa Crawford, and what she said about the way young people are much more individualistic, they're much more aware of lifestyle options, and she said that life for them is like a degustation menu, you know, that's all these different experiences that they're able to amble along and feel reasonably self-centered and comfortable until something dramatic has, you know, leads to a change in their circumstances or confronts their opportunistic approach to life. You know, it might be having to do the HSE, it might be not being able to get a job, it might be shifting to a different city, who knows, could be all sorts of things. But some interesting reading there, and I hope you will have a look at it. I think that this prolongation of adolescence is a real problem, and it's one that I guess I'm a bit biased about, because I've known a few young people who I think illustrate the difficulties here, and you know, I think of one who must be in 12 to 14 hours a week playing computer games, and he's 40. And I think to myself, what's going to happen to his relationship? Is he going to keep playing computer games when he's 50? I would think it's more relaxing to watch sport on TV than to do this, and I just don't understand it. I guess I'm very prejudiced. I think I would have given that up when I was 8, playing things like that. It's like the... So you can see my bias on that one. You'll also notice that number 10, this seems to become an issue for a lot of young people today, that they live in a low level of anxiety about their presence on Facebook, how they're going, what other people think of them, what's the image they're projecting, and they can get preoccupied with describing their whole life on social media, so much so that it may well be affecting people's capacity to relate face to face. My own personal experience is that I've seen people who spend so much time on their phone or tablets or whatever it is, and when they come to talk to you, they can't look at you in the eyes for any length of time. They're looking down at their phone, which is always there, waiting for some cosmic message from outside world to come in that's going to be eminently more important than actually talking to me. And so I sort of feel that, you know, somehow they're not really present, they can't really connect with me, and I feel somewhat disappointed, and I think they're paying more attention to this little baby that they're nursing and carrying, and I think that they may be losing the capacity to read the emotions in people's eyes and faces, to see how other people are feeling just from the look on their face, that they're losing the capacity to read real people because they're preoccupied with most of the stuff that, you know, that comes through. And my impression is just trivial. You know, it's just descriptive. It's like I've seen people come in, sit down at a meal at a restaurant, and instead of saying grace before meals, as you would have in a traditional religious society, they pull out their phone, they take photographs of the food, they put it to Instagram, and they tell the whole world that they are in this restaurant eating this piece of salmon. And I'm just amazed. I think, is this some sort of disease? When I drive down the road at Anzac Parade, I often find large numbers of people from University of New South Wales walking across one of the busy streets in Sydney, even though there are lights, and they're pawing at their phones. You know, they might trip on the railway line that's going in or trip on the gutter, but they're walking across the street, and I've nearly run over one or two people that have gone through the red do not walk light because they're so absorbed in what's on their phone, and they never look at anybody else's phone. There's like digital phone envy, you know, the stuff on my screen's better than the stuff on someone else's screen. We don't want somebody to look at yours because it mightn't be as interesting as... So all these sort of things are sorts of questions that I think even adults have got to face up to as a big issue, and not just kids. But you can see, as we will get to when we come to section six, it's no use just giving kids a sermon on the problems with social media or digital communications. They won't listen to that. It's a waste of time. The only way to do something, and you can't solve the problem, is get them to do research on this and find out what's going on, see what the accident rates are for kids playing with phones. And you find in England it's very high. A lot of kids are either killed or injured because they walk across the street distracted by a smartphone. You know, so they're a health hazard. I'm not anti-phones, but I think along with lots of things, like as we'll see when we come to do the many research projects, there are lots of things available in the culture that are not necessarily bad or good, but it's how you use them culturally for your own self-understanding, your own self-expression. And we're all prone to getting addicted to things, so there's a potential problem there. So I hope that you'll have a look through the 10 characteristics, generalised characteristics of contemporary spirituality of youth, and I hope it would be useful. It's the sort of thing that you could get students themselves to explore and evaluate and see whether they agree or not. Or at least to be stimulated to thinking seriously about the issues that are there. Then it comes to part seven, the concluding part of this section, and it again is a bit of a summary. It draws together the points that have been made earlier. How do we, as a religious school, do something to educate spiritually and morally the students we have, who have a birthright to a knowledge and understanding of their own religious tradition, but we think that may not be enough for making sense of life in a particularly challenging culture. So we want to do something else to help resource their basic human spirituality. So that completes the section four. The next one will be about children's spirituality, not just valuable for people who teach at primary school level, but for those in the secondary as well, who need to have an understanding of what's going on there.